Mr. Hayes, Real 8, we were talking about your time in billets in Helmand, and you mentioned this French sort of volunteer liaison person. What sort of tricks did he play?
Well, he'd always use his Watson of the language to his advantage.
In what way?
Well, if there was a better billet that he could get into as opposed to the one he was in, he would use it because he knew the language. And we got to dislike him immensely because he did some... He did on Stan anyway. Stan had found a lady friend in Ypres, and after he'd gone on leave, you know, during that particular period, and he put it about that he'd written to Stan's wife about what was going on, and so Stan was very upset about it. He hadn't actually, but he was a nasty piece of good. He eventually at Blue. We picked him up in Blücher land, and eventually, when we went to Germany, he was no longer any use to us. So he was not sent to the French army, and eventually he was commissioned, and he fought at Diemben Fieu, whatever it was called. You know, the one that the French got a lace in it, and picture of him in one of the books, but I didn't particularly know him. And
do you know his name?
No. I could find it out for you very quickly, but
it's all right. It's all right. We're looking at it.
anyway,
so you're in these billets. Anything happened while you were at Helmand?
Yeah, something happened to him. He was probably having an affair with somebody's wife, and we were all lined up, and somebody come running down the road with a Dutchman with a big carving knife running behind him. Oh dear, but. I think, after, of course, then when we eventually went back to Ypres and we were sent in the yard again, of course, he was in his element then, because when we were at Ypres, they were Flemish speaking. When we went into the yard then, they spoke Walloon, which was a dialect of French, so we had it made again.
We'll come back on to that. Now, what happened next? How long were you at Helmand then?
Oh. About a week, I think. I can't remember, to tell you the truth.
And then, what was your next move? Was that when you went to...
Ypres.
And what happened?
The tanks off at Brussels. And then we went on to Ypres. And...
What sort of reception... You went into billets there as well, I presume.
Yeah.
What sort of billets and reception did you have from the Belgians?
Very, very good, because we were the first, apart from stragglers, we were the first... There were two regiments in there, which I didn't realise at the time. There was the Fighting Force and the 11th Hussars. Anyway, 23rd Hussars.
So what sort of a reception did they give you?
Very, very good indeed. Very, very good. And Stan was in, we were in St. Nicholas Street. And Stan was, I was with another one of the troops, I can't remember there. But Stan was in the place next door. Well, the strange thing was that there were two women in that villa, plus the mother. And the mother was a dour, sort of big maid woman, and very strict in that sense, except their daughters gave her the running name. Anyway, Stan struck up an affair with the youngest one, Betty, I think her name was. And when he was on leave, I decided I would go around, because they invited me round for tea. I couldn't speak a word of French, so it was very interesting what went on. But we realised what was going on, because they were very... At the back of the house we were in, there was an extension on the back of next door, which was a very long room, and they employed about at least 8 machinists in there. And they were the ones, these two girls were the, you know, the haute couture or whatever it is. They were really mustered at, you know, design and clothes. So all the Belgian women obviously came there to get their clothes made. Now, it was a strange thing that happened, because the officers picked the best billets they could find. And because they wanted to show their appreciation, they would occasionally bring their policeman with a bottle of whiskey. You know, that was their ration. So eventually, when the women wanted something made, they would in turn bring the same bottle of whiskey to present to the girls that made the tackle. Now, when we were invited, Stan, we were very regularly invited in there, and always there was a bottle of whiskey on the table, so I thought, well, this is ironical. This, the officers are doing a good turn, as they thought, because the Belgian women wouldn't particularly drink whiskey. You know, they're like brandy and what have you. What's the name? Whiskey was a bit raw for them. So we used to knock, Stan and I and the girls, even knock this bottle of whiskey up. And I thought, well, if only the officers knew where I was on into the bottle of whiskey. But anyway, that was by the by, but it was one of those things.
Were you still on, what were you doing at this stage then? You were still on the petrol lorry?
Yeah, no, I wasn't. I was dense back with the fitters. Because when we got into Ypres, they said, right, well, there's no tanks, because they were left of Prussians. We'll strip all the Bedford engines down and give them a decoke, or whatever we call them in those days. So we were stationed in the gendarmerie, and it was two of us to a wagon, and we'd, you know, strip the top overhaul, as you used to call it.
How did you do that? How did you go about?
Well, you took, because they were overhead camshafts, you know, you'd strip the top off, and then you'd go one step further, you'd take that off, and then you'd be onto your pistons. So you'd either, you know, clean the top of your pistons off and fiddle about. But what happened at that particular period, they ran into a big lot of trouble, because they decided, powers that be, that they would replace all the Bedford engines. You know, when there was a blank spot in the action. The only trouble was they were all duff. So they were stripping engines out. And the ones they were stripping out were better than the ones that they'd sent all from England. And it caused a heck of a problem. So bad that what they did, in the end, they got tank transporters and welded, you know, some, I forget what it was, these things that are used for airfields, you know, as landing things, you know, metal things. And they'd weld them along the outside and they'd land with, you know, cans of petrol. It's the only way they could bring the petrol, because most of the Bedford vehicles were no good. That's when we started to get a lot of Canadian wagons. And, per se, we were in the gendarmerie at the time. And it was one of these situations where we thought, oh, we're made here, you know. Waiting for these new tanks, and we haven't got them in.
This was because you'd handed in your Shermans, yeah, and you were waiting the Comets, weren't they? You hadn't got them yet, had they?
No. So anyway, waiting around there, and the people in Ypres, they were very, very kind. They decided they would put a dance on for us, and the ladies of the house would bring their, you know, what's that? So anyway, we got there, and Stan was there with, I don't know who he was with. And I had never been used to drinking spirits. Well, there was no beer there in the town hall. So I was on to the brandies. And I couldn't dance, but I could then that night. Stan said I was going down the floor like a whirling dervish. But you're probably right as well. Anyway, I was absolutely kale-eyed. And Elsa, the landlady, virtually carried me home. And it was all taken in very good part, and it was the next day that they said, and we started to strip some of the vehicles down. Right, they said, don't bother at first parade in the morning, just go to your place of work, and, you know, wander down about 9 o'clock. They the exile said, right, whatever you do, don't strip anything else down, and where you've got a bed for half stripped down, two of you get on it and try. He said, anything that you can get back on the road by 12 o'clock is going with us. The rest are staying here. So we still didn't know what was going on. So anyway, we got stuck in, and we eventually got a certain amount of these Bedfords, most of them going, I would think. And but anyway, then we started off to to Brussels to pick up the tanks.
Now, this was the emergency, was the Ardennes offensive, wasn't it?
And apparently they got the word in the middle of the night to our, you know, headquarters. And they said, Mark Conway apparently said, what have you got in reserve? They said, 29th Armour Division. But, said, but what? They've got no tanks. You know, get them tanks immediately, you know. So anyway, virtually what they did, they whipped us up to Brussels, and the tank crews were taken into the big, you know, tank delivery squadron place, and half the tanks, they hadn't they hadn't started stripping down, and unfortunately, well, most of them were, you know, still in running order, and they said what did they do? Well, they didn't have to tell us, but they were panicking in Brussels. You know, because the Germans were coming back, as they thought. So what they did, instead of going straight up to the Ardennes, they whipped it round Brussels a few times, the whole one of the tanks that bolstered around the line of it. And up we started, and the tanks went up. But a few of them broke down, which then it was our job to get them back on the road.
What sort of breakdowns would they have?
Oh, engines overheating, you know, they hadn't put enough water in, or...
This was in the rush?
Yeah, it was in the rush, yeah. And so what we did what we could. And place we were.
Was there anything you could do about an overheated engine? Or would it just seize up?
Just so much, simple as that.
What other breakdowns might you have on that?
I don't know, someone maybe shed a track if it hadn't been tightened properly. And because once it got there, it would have to be virtually MOT before it went to another unit. But they hadn't bothered. You know, they just dump them there, and most of them picked up their own tanks.
So how would you replace a track? Can you remember?
Yeah, I do. Well, they've got to...
It's not easy, is it?
No, it isn't. What they've got to do is get a piece of level ground, they break the track, and then pull the... They were different than an English tank, because... Their driving sprocket was at the front in the American tank. Our driving sprocket was at the back. So it was an entirely different procedure. And you had a piece of cable on the tank. And you would pull this off the top of the idlers, off the top, and lay it out in front of you. And then when you got it all sorted and you'd checked all the links and everything, you would then have to bring it back. But you'd do it from the back on a shim, because you had to bring it over the idler at the back and over the sprocket at the front. And what you did, you had to get a track and you'd put this cable that thick, and you'd bring it over the idlers and then connect it to, it was a bit tricky to connect it to the sprocket, and then turn the sprocket over slowly and it would gradually pull the track over the idlers. And then when you got it so far, you'd obviously marry the track up again. But it was strange. There was the Americans had disappeared.
Now, just one before you go on, one other thing. What about sometimes tracks got slack, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
And what would you do then?
Well, there was two ways of doing that. The American tanks, I'm sure they had a funny gadget that would... Sometimes you'd have to take a link out, but there was a way. We on our English tanks, they had a different way. They would have the idler, which was at the front of ours. That was on a pivot, and you could take some of the slack off. And that you weren't supposed to do it, but what they used to do was we had a track adjusting tool, and it was about 6 foot long, about that wide, and about that in depth, but about that wide, and it was virtually a two-man job. You'd put it in to this, the idler part, and you could lift it or drop it down, and you'd have to undo the locking mechanism, and then you could swing this idler, so you'd bring, if obviously you wanted to tighten the track, you'd bring it forward, you know, you'd bring it, or vice versa, if it slacked a bit, the track would be too tight. But it was strange. We got a very, very good billet when we got on the outskirts of I can't remember whether we were at, it was either Nemours or Dinant. I can't remember which. Different regiments, different. And there was the Rifle Brigade. Actually, what they did when we were heading out towards Brussels, we met them on the way coming back to Ypres. They'd been kept up there for a while. And we just said, turn around, you go up the Ardennes. And, which they did. And it was a strange and eerie. What's the name? We were billeted in this house, which was showing you photographs of the family that we were billeted with. And they were a smashing family. And the one thing that sticks in my
mind. This is at Dinant, you think, but you're not sure.
I'm not sure. It was Dinant on the north. It was the one where, when you went across the bridge, there was a hole, you know, sort of drilled through the rock there. And I'm sure it was the one on my left, you know, was. There were three bridges there. There was Dinant, you know, and another one that I can't remember, which wasn't anything to do with us. Anyway, we got in there, and all the neighbours came in to welcome us. Apparently, they didn't go a bundle of Americans. I don't know why. They're quite civilised, most of them. And anyway, they said, "What would you like to eat?" And we started to go through the little. Six Wilson, who we had with us, that could speak a bit of French, he was interpreting for us, and we decided we'd like fish and chips. Right, fish and chips. We shall have. So, no, not fish and chips, chips and egg. So anyway, the Russian leaves me, and put in front of me, and they said, before we start to eat, anybody like any more? And I said, yes, I would, please. What I didn't know was the fact that they cooked the chips in was rancid. Now, I had asked for extra chips as well, and it was quite a tackle to get it down. It really rancid, the fact they probably, I don't know, they use different things in different countries, but it was absolutely rancid. Anyway, they eventually.
Did it make you ill?
No. The guts were immune to food poisoning in those days. But then it was Christmas Eve, I'm sure it was Christmas Eve. And they said to us, you're a lovely family. I'll use the plural of saying families. They said, we all sat down in the one room, and there was about 10 of us. Maybe, I can't remember, you can tell by the picture. And we all bedded down in this one particular room, and we said, leave your boots out. And we thought, oh, not having this, you know, cleaning our boots. Anyway, we did what we were told, and how in hell's name they remembered who was what, I don't know. But anyway, when we got up in the morning, our boots were outside the door, highly polished, with this little photograph album. It was outside. That was just the day before. How the heck did they print it? I don't know, but they did, and they made these little albums. And on the front of each album, there was our, you know, first initial of our Christian name. And anyway, there was that in it, and a bag of sweets or chocolates or whatever, with in it as well, with a ribbon, a Belgian, you know, ribbon tied round it. And, you know, I was absolutely amazed. And obviously the girls must have virtually sat on a whole night making these out of, you know, bits of wallpaper and all sorts. And I've always treasured that. It's got a bit battered now. But I've always treasured that. Anyway, eventually we went down into the town. And there was no troops at all around in the town at the time. And you'd find a canal, and there'd be a sentry box at the other end. And you'd think, who's going to be in there? So you'd be like, hello there, hello, are you American? Anyway, there weren't any Germans left in the town, thank God. But anyway, eventually, we didn't go over the first time. Some strange things happened. there was a big mechanical supply depot there. And some of that things said, oh, they could do the sea distributors for the Jeep. For the Jeep. They've got a compliment of Jeeps, they've got probably got about 10. And when they got in there, they said, how are you buying another distributor? Those boxes there, they hold one Jeep engine. How many do you want? Because it was ideal to be better, you know. So many Jeeps we've got, about 10. So I've taken them, you know. But eventually, we did go over the river. And this is where Frenchy annoyed a heck of a lot of people. Because he was doing his usual pattern, looking for the best boat he could for himself. And he got fixed up in this chateau. But we were in, there was about six of us in this one farmhouse. And we were quite happy where we went and had a good fire on. We were probably getting our rations from the cook truck at the time. And I think they made an attempt to paint some of the tanks white to, you know, sort of camouflage them against the snow. And anyway, this Frenchie one day, he said, I've had an invitation to you fellows to go up to the big house for a meal. Oh, very good. So they said, but, here's a but. Will you go and collect your ration, you know, your cook from the cook truck into your mess things and bring them with you? I thought, well, you can put it in their pig bin when you get there. So we said, well, if that's the, and this was unanimous, you know, sort of, if that's the conditions, you can go and tell the people, the woman in the shelter or whatever it was, she can stick her dinner, which she obviously did, or tried to. But there's another strange thing that happened there. Outside, it was like a no man's land of who, nobody knew who was doing what. And there was a deserted chateau or something, I don't know what it was. And outside it, there was a German. It was a copy of the original Volkswagen car, but it was the German army version. And it had run off the road and was up against the tree like that, outside this place, just ignored it. Anyway, there was some passing Americans, and they spotted this, and they could see a light flickering in one of the rooms. So, what was happening was, and I wasn't there at the time, but I can quite understand it happening, the candles that were flickering were the fellas on that particular floor to play brag, which was their main hobby, losing one of them money than one of them. And it was very quiet, and they were just, they were very conscious on this brag or whatever it was they were playing. And all of a sudden, the door was kicked in, and two American GIs jumped in with Tommy guns, and they said something. What we're going to do, and the fellow that was playing the cards, I think he was dealing the cards at the time, he slowly looked up and told him everything where to go in more uncertain terms, and went out very sheepish then. But it wasn't the language it used, if they were using good language, they'd say, "Awah and boy, it's hatties," but it wasn't that. Very downhearted at what reception they got, and apparently they just went on playing cards and just ignored these Americans if they didn't exist.
So what had the Americans thought?
There was some Germans in there that were, you know, sort of holed up there, and they could see this flickering of the candle, and they thought, oh, we've got somebody here that we can say we captured some Germans. But they're an absolute shambles. They didn't know what they were doing there, and then. And, you know, it's all right saying that, but we found out after, they were pretty low-grade troops anyway, if there is such a thing.
What, the Americans?
Yeah. In that particular sector, some of them had just taken off, and some of them ended up in Paris. And one fellow got executed out in the lot. make an example of him. One fellow got shot. But we were a long time getting the Americans back. But
what about the weather? Because it was getting cold, wasn't it? And well, cold. More than cold.
It was bitter. And the tank crews had been issued with these tank suits. And a few of them had succumbed to American Yankee dollar and sold the tank suits. And when they got on the air and asked for another couple of trucks, I never knew that. I never saw the Colonel the whole time I was with that unit. I wouldn't know him if it had fallen over him at the time, Bill Scott. But apparently he was a very, very good colonel. And he was wounded at one time, and they said that, you know, the unit nearly fell to pieces while he was away. He came back eventually. And anyway,
you were talking about the tank suits and how cold it was.
So we were in this farmhouse, and, you know, we were very warm, and I managed to warm the animals on a dairy night for a little while. But they all used to disappear, because the only information we got was from the BBC, and they got a radio in the house, so they disappeared and left me looking after this farm girl. And she wasn't very pretty, but what can you do? But anyway,
How much did it affect? I mean, the road conditions were supposed to be very bad.
I don't know how the tanks held or what's next door, because you'd be going down hairpin bends and you could see them. You know, if they didn't keep the power on, they'd start to just go sideways, heading for the side, you know. But the Americans gradually got there. In actual fact, I think it was Patton that brought some of these troops up from wherever they were. And, you know, sort of got in between us and the Oxfam. And I think the first thing they did was build up one of our tanks. But in the book, it said that the colonel, and now he would not use this terminology, it said the American terminology, that he came on the air and he said to the Americans, "You have just browned one of my tanks." He would not have used that sort of language, although it was innocuous, but he would never have used it because it didn't come into our vocabulary. "You brewed one of my tanks up." Yes, but not browned one of my tanks. Anyway, eventually we did have a bit of a tussle on Chapel Hill. And I think we lost two or three tanks on that. I can't remember. But it was the point that the Germans furthest they got towards... Was it the Mars? Was it the Mars? And I mean, we the idea of us going up there, the idea was that we were going to blow the bridge. But if we had the order to blow the bridge, there were not a lot of Americans who had been stuck to the other side, so they didn't blow it. But there were a few minor battles on Hill 112. I think we lost one or two tanks up there. And after the war, my brother-in-law lived in Belgium, so he took us back to the Ardennes, and we found this chapel. And on the outside of it, he said, "Look at that notice on the wall." Now, I don't speak French, but he spoke a little bit. And it was Défense Journée, and it meant "Don't pay on the church wall," which was common practice all there. So, well, that's he said, "Take a photograph of that." I don't know if I got one in the end. But anyway, we stayed up there till it, you know, sort of quieted down. And then...
So what were you doing, you as a fitter?
We were doing very little because it was too cold to work on the tanks, really. So we just stayed and kept warm in dairy mates and one thing. But, eventually they decided the Americans had stabilised it. But then the strange thing happened. We came back, and I thought, what's going on here? The trams are still running. We'd come back through Luxembourg. And you only knew through Luxembourg in, you know, half an hour. But it was strange. And it was almost like the war hadn't affected them at all. And
so you went back to
Ypres. But In the meantime, we'd left our Christmas dinner there, which the Belgians had never eaten.